not forgive Kay for the rude, outstretched plate. The woman was bolshy and patronizing, exactly like Lisa, who had monopolized every get-together with her political views and her job in family law, despising Samantha for owning a bra shop. "Adam and Janice?" she reminded Miles in parentheses, who nodded. "And they couldn't get a baby for love nor money, could they?" "Yes, a baby," said Kay, rolling her eyes. "Everybody wants a baby. Robbie's nearly four. He's not potty trained. He's developmentally behind for his age, and he's almost certainly had inappropriate exposure to sexual behaviour. Would your friends like to adopt him?"
"But the point is, if he'd been taken from his mother at birth..."
"She was off drugs when he was born and making good progress," said Kay. "She loved him and wanted to keep him, and she was meeting his needs at the time. She'd already raised Crystal with some family support."
"Crystal!" shrieked Samantha. "Oh my God, are we talking about the Whedons?"
Kay was horrified that she had used names. It had never mattered in London, but everyone truly did know everyone in Pagford, it seemed. "I shouldn't have..." But Miles and Samantha were laughing, and Mary looked tense. Kay, who had not touched her pie and had managed very little of the first course, realized that she had drunk too much. She had been sipping wine steadily out of nerves, and now she had committed a prime indiscretion. Still, it was too late to undo that. Anger overrode every other consideration.
"Crystal Whedon is no advert for that woman's mothering skills," said Miles.
"Crystal's trying her damnest to hold her family together," said Kay. "She loves her little brother very much. She's terrified he'll be taken away."
"I wouldn't trust Crystal Whedon to look after a boiling egg," said Miles, and Samantha laughed again. "Oh, look, it's to her credit she loves her brother, but he isn't a cuddly toy."
"Yes, I know that," snapped Kay, remembering Robbie's shitty, crusted bottom. "But he's still loved."
"Crystal bullied our daughter Lexi," said Samantha, "so we've seen a different side of her to the one I'm sure she shows you."
"Look, we all know Crystal's had a rough deal," said Miles. "Nobody's denying that. It's the drug-addled mother I've got an issue with."
"As a matter of fact, she's doing very well on the Bell Chapel programme at the moment."
"But with her history," said Miles, "it isn't rocket science, is it, to guess that she'll relapse?"
"If you apply that rule across the board, you ought not to have a driving licence, because with your history, you're bound to drink and drive again." Miles was temporarily baffled, but Samantha said coldly,
"I think that's a rather different thing."
"Do you?" said Kay. "It's the same principle."
"Yes, well, principles are sometimes the problem, if you ask me," said Miles. "Often, what's needed is a bit of common sense."
"Which is the name people usually give to their prejudices," rejoined Kay.
"According to Nietzsche," said a sharp new voice, making them all jump, "philosophy is the biography of the philosopher."
A miniature Samantha stood at the door into the hall, a busty girl of around 16 in tight jeans and a T-shirt. She was eating a handful of grapes and looking rather pleased with herself.
"Everyone meet Lexi," said Miles proudly. "Thank you for that, genius."
"You're welcome," said Lexi pertly, and she swept off upstairs.
A heavy silence sank over the table.
Without really knowing why, Samantha, Miles and Kay all glanced towards Mary, who looked as though she might be on the verge of tears.
"Coffee?"
said Samantha, lurching to her feet. Mary disappeared into the bathroom.
"Let's go and sit through," said Miles,
conscious that the atmosphere was somewhat charged, but confident that he could, with a few jokes and his habitual bonhomie, steer everyone back into charity with each other.
"Bring your glasses."
His inner certainties had been no more rearranged by Kay's arguments than a breeze can move a boulder, yet his feeling towards her was not unkind, but rather pitying. He was the least intoxicated by the constant refilling of glasses, but on reaching the sitting room, he realised how very full his bladder was.
"Whack on some music, Gav, and I'll go and get those chockies."
But Gavin made no move towards the vertical stacks of CDs in their sleek, perspex stands. He seemed to be waiting for Kay to start on him. Sure enough,
As soon as Miles had vanished from sight, Kay said, "Well, thank you very much, Gav. Thanks for all the support." Gavin had drunk even more greedily than Kay throughout dinner, enjoying his own private celebration that he had not, after all, been offered up as a sacrifice to Samantha's gladiatorial bullying. He faced Kay squarely, full of a courage born not only of wine, but because he had been treated for an hour as somebody important, knowledgeable and supportive by Mary. "You seem to be doing okay on your own," he said. Indeed, the little he had permitted himself to hear of Kay and Miles's argument had given him a profound sense of déjà vu. If he had not had Mary to distract him, he might have fancied himself back on that famous evening in the identical dining room when Lisa had told Miles that he epitomized all that was wrong with society, and Miles had laughed in her face, and Lisa had lost her temper and refused to stay for coffee. It was not very long after that Lisa had admitted that she was sleeping with an associate partner at her firm and advised Gavin to get tested for chlamydia. "I don't know any of these people," said Kay, "and you haven't done one damn thing to make it any easier for me, have you?" "What did you want me to do?" asked Gavin. He was wonderfully calm, insulated by the imminent returns of the Mollisons and Mary and by the copious amounts of Chianti he had consumed. "I didn't want an argument about the fields. I don't give a monkey's about the fields. Plus," he added, "it's a touchy subject around Mary. Barry was fighting on the council to keep the fields part of Pagford."
"Well, then, why couldn't you have told me, given me a hint?"
He laughed, exactly as Miles had laughed at her. Before she could retort, the others returned like the magi bearing gifts. Samantha carrying a tray of cups, followed by Mary holding the cafetiere, and Miles with Kay's chocolates. Kay saw the flamboyant gold ribbon on the box and remembered how optimistic she'd been about tonight when she had bought them. She turned her face away, trying to hide her anger, frantic with the desire to shout at Gavin, and also with a sudden, shocking urge to cry.
"It's been so nice," she heard Mary say, in a thick voice that suggested she too might have been crying. "But I won't stay for coffee. I don't want to be late back. Declan's a bit unsettled at the moment. Thanks so much, Sam. Miles, it's been good to, you know, well, get out for a bit."
"I'll walk you up there," Miles began, but Gavin was talking firmly over him.
"You stay here, Miles. I'll see Mary back. I'll walk you up the road, Mary. It'll only take 5 minutes. It's dark up the top there."
Kay was barely breathing. All her being was concentrated in loathing of complacent Miles, tarty Samantha, and fragile, drooping Mary, but most of all, of Gavin himself. "Oh yes," she heard herself saying, as everybody seemed to look towards her for permission. "Yep. You see Mary home, Gav." She heard the front door close and Gavin had gone. Miles was pouring Kay's coffee. She watched the stream of hot black liquid fall and felt suddenly, painfully alive to what she had risked in overthrowing her life for the man walking away into the night with another woman.
8. Colin Wall saw Gavin and Mary pass under his study window. He recognized Mary's silhouette at once, but had to squint to identify the stringy man at her side before they moved out of the aureole cast by the streetlight. Crouching, half raised out of his computer chair, Colin gaped after the figures as they disappeared into the darkness. He was shocked to his core, having taken it for granted that Mary was in a kind of purdah, that she was receiving only women in the sanctuary of her own home, among them Tessa, who was still visiting every other day. Never had it occurred to him that Mary might be socializing after dark, least of all with a single man. He felt personally betrayed, as though Mary, on some spiritual level, was cuckolding him. Had Mary permitted Gavin see Barry's body? Was Gavin spending evening sitting in Barry's favorite seat by the fire? Were Gavin and Mary... could they possibly be... such things happened, after all, every day. Perhaps even before Barry's death. Colin was perennially appalled by the threadbare state of other people's morals.
He tried to insulate himself against shocks by pushing himself to imagine the worst, by conjuring awful visions of depravity and betrayal rather than waiting for the truth to rip like a shell through his innocent delusions. Life for Colin was one long brace against pain and disappointment, and everybody apart from his wife was an enemy until they had proven otherwise. He was half inclined to rush downstairs to tell Tessa what he had just seen, because she might be able to give him an innocuous explanation of Mary's nighttime stroll, and to reassure him that his best friend's widow had been and was still faithful to her husband. Nonetheless, he resisted the urge, because he was angry with Tessa. Why was she showing such a determined lack of interest in his forthcoming candidacy for the council? Did she not realize how tight a stranglehold his anxiety had gained over him ever since he'd sent in his application form? Even though he had expected to feel this way, the pain was not diminished by anticipation, any more than being hit by a train would be less devastating for seeing it approaching down the track. Colin merely suffered twice, in the expectation and in its realization. His nightmarish new fantasies swirled around the Mollisons and the way in which they were likely to attack him. Counter-arguments, explanations, and extenuations ran constantly through his mind. He saw himself already besieged, fighting for his reputation. The edge of paranoia, always apparent in Colin's dealings with the world, was becoming more pronounced, and meanwhile Tessa was pretending to be oblivious, doing absolutely nothing to help alleviate the dreadful, crushing strain. He knew that she did not think he ought to be standing. Perhaps she too was terrified that Howard Mollison would slit open the bulging gut of their past and spill its ghastly secrets for all the Pagford vultures to pick over. Colin had already made a few telephone calls to those whom Barry had counted on for support. He had been surprised and heartened that not one of them had challenged his credentials or interrogated him on the issues. Without exception, they had expressed their profound sorrow at the loss of Barry and their intense dislike of Howard Mollison, or that great smug bastard, as one of the blunter voters had called him, trying to crowbar in his son. He could hardly stop himself grinning when he heard Barry was dead. Colin, who had compiled a list of pro-Fields talking points, had not needed to refer to the paper once. So far, his main appeal as a candidate seemed to be that he was Barry's friend, and that he was not called Mollison. His miniature, black-and-white face was smiling at him out of the computer monitor. He had been sitting here all evening, trying to compose his election pamphlet, for which he had decided to use the same photograph as was featured on the Winterdown website, full face, with a slightly anodyne grin, his forehead steep and shiny. The image had in its favour the fact that it had already been submitted to the public gaze, and had not brought down ridicule or ruin upon him, a powerful recommendation. But beneath the photograph, where the personal information ought to have been, were only one or two tentative sentences. Colin had spent most of the last 2 hours composing and then deleting words. At one point, he had managed to complete an entire paragraph, only to destroy it, backspace by backspace, with a nervous, jabbing forefinger. Unable to bear the indecision and solitude, he jumped up and went downstairs. Tessa was lying on the sofa in the sitting room, apparently dozing, with the television on in the background. "How's it going?" she asked sleepily, opening her eyes. "Mary's just gone by, walking up the street with Gavin Hughes." "Oh," said Tessa. "She said something about going over to Miles and Samantha's earlier. Gavin must have been there. He's probably walking her home." Colin was appalled. Mary visiting Miles, the man who sought to fill her husband's shoes, who stood in opposition to all that Barry had fought for. What on earth was she doing at the Mollisons? "They went with her to the hospital, you know that," said Tessa, sitting up with a small groan and stretching her short legs. "She hadn't spoken to them properly since. She wanted to thank them. Have you finished your pamphlet?" "I'm nearly there. Listen, with the information, I mean, as far as the personal information goes, pass posts, do you think, or limit it to Winterdown? I don't think you need to say more than where you work now. But why don't you ask Minda?" "She," Tessa yawned, "she's done it herself." "Yes, said Colin. He waited, standing over her, but she did not offer to help, or even to read what he had written so far.
Yes, that's a good idea, he said more loudly. I'll get Minda to look over it.
She grunted, massaging her ankles, and he left the room, full of wounded pride. His wife could not possibly realize what a state he was in, how little sleep he was getting, or how his stomach was gnawing itself from within. Tessa had only pretended to be asleep. Mary and Gavin's footsteps had woken her 10 minutes previously. Tessa barely knew Gavin. He was 15 years younger than her and Colin, but the main barrier towards intimacy had always been Colin's tendency to be jealous of Barry's other friendships.
He's been amazing about the insurance, Mary had told Tessa on the telephone earlier. He's on the phone to them every day, from what I can gather, and he keeps telling me not to worry about fees. Oh, God, Tessa, if they don't pay out.
Gavin will sort it out for you, said Tessa. I'm sure he will. It would have been nice, thought Tessa, stiff and thirsty on the sofa, if she and Colin could have had Mary round to the house, to give her a change of scene and make sure she was eating. But there was one insuperable barrier. Mary found Colin difficult, a strain. This uncomfortable and hitherto concealed fact had emerged slowly in the wake of Barry's death, like flotsam revealed by the ebbing tide. It could not have been plainer that Mary wanted only Tessa. She shied away from suggestions that Colin might help with anything, and avoided talking to him too long on the telephone. They had met so often as a foursome for years, and Mary's antipathy had never surfaced. Barry's good humour must have cloaked it. Tessa had to manage the new state of affairs with great delicacy. She had successfully persuaded Colin that Mary was happiest in the company of other women. The funeral had been her one failure, because Colin had ambushed Mary as they all left St. Michael's and tried to explain, through racking sobs, that he was going to stand for Barry's seat on the council, to carry on Barry's work, to make sure Barry prevailed posthumously. Tessa had seen Mary's shocked and offended expression and pulled him away. Once or twice since, Colin had stated his intention of going over to show Mary all his election materials, to ask whether Barry would have approved of them, even voiced an intention of seeking guidance from Mary as to how Barry would have handled the process of canvassing for votes. In the end, Tessa had told him firmly that he must not badger Mary about the parish council. He became huffy at this, but it was better, Tessa thought, that he should be angry with her rather than adding to Mary's distress or provoking her into a rebuff, as had happened over the viewing of Barry's body.
"The Mollisons, though," said Colin, re-entering the room with a cup of tea. He had not offered Tessa one. He was often selfish in these little ways, too busy with his own worries to notice. Of all the people for her to have dinner with, they were against everything Barry stood for.
"That's a bit melodramatic, Cole," said Tessa. Anyway, Mary was never as interested in the Fields as Barry. But Colin's only understanding of love was of limitless loyalty, boundless tolerance. Mary had fallen irreparably in his estimation.
9. "And where are you going?" asked Simon, planting himself squarely in the middle of the tiny hall. The front door was open, and the glass porch behind him, full of shoes and coats, was blinding in the bright Saturday morning sun, turning Simon into a silhouette. His shadow rippled up the stairs, just touching the one on which Andrew stood.
"Into town with Fats. Homework all finished, is it?"
"Yeah." It was a lie, but Simon would not bother to check.
"Ruth! Ruth!"
She appeared at the kitchen door, wearing an apron, flushed, with her hands covered in flour.
"What? Do we need anything from town?"
"What? No, I don't think so."
"Taking my bike, are you?"
demanded Simon of Andrew.
"Yeah, I was going to."
"Leaving it at Fat's house?"
"Yeah."
"What time do we want him back?" Simon asked, turning to Ruth again.
"Oh, I don't know, Si," said Ruth impatiently.
The furthest she ever went in irritation with her husband was on occasions when Simon, though basically in a good mood, started laying down the law for the fun of it. Andrew and Fats often went into town together, on the vague understanding that Andrew would return before it became dark.
5 o'clock, then, said Simon, arbitrarily. Any later and you're grounded.
Fine, Andrew replied. He kept his right hand in his jacket pocket, clenched over a tightly folded wad of paper, intensely aware of it, like a ticking grenade. The fear of losing this piece of paper, on which was inscribed a line of meticulously written code and a number of crossed-out, reworked and heavily edited sentences, had been plaguing him for a week. He had been keeping it on him at all times and sleeping with it inside his pillowcase. Simon barely moved aside so that Andrew had to edge past him into the porch, his fingers clamped over the paper. He was terrified that Simon would demand that he turn out his pockets, ostensibly looking for cigarettes.
Bye then.
Simon did not answer. Andrew proceeded into the garage, where he took out the note, unfolded it, and read it. He knew that he was being irrational, that mere proximity to Simon could not have magically switched the papers, but still he made sure. Satisfied that all was safe, he refolded it, tucked it deeper into his pocket, which fastened with a stud, then wheeled the racing bike out of the garage and down through the gate into the lane. He could tell that his father was watching him through the glass door of the porch, hoping, Andrew was sure, to see him fall off or mistreat the bicycle in some way. Pagford lay below Andrew, slightly hazy in the cool spring sun, the air fresh and tangy. Andrew sensed the point at which Simon's eyes could no longer follow him. It felt as though pressure had been removed from his back. Down the hill into Pagford he streaked, not touching the brakes. Then he turned into Church Row. Approximately halfway along the street he slowed down and cycled decorously into the drive of the Walls' house, taking care to avoid Cubby's car. "Hello, Andy," said Tessa, opening the front door to him. "Hi, Mrs. Wall." Andrew accepted the convention that Fats's parents were laughable. Tessa was plump and plain, her hairstyle was odd and her dress sense embarrassing, while Cubby was comically uptight. Yet Andrew could not help but suspect that if the Walls had been his parents, he might have been tempted to like them. They were so civilized, so courteous. He never had the feeling in their house that the floor might suddenly give way and plunge you into chaos. Fats was sitting on the bottom stair, putting on his trainers. A packet of loose tobacco was clearly visible, peeking out of the breast pocket of his jacket.
"Arf. Fats.
Do you want to leave your father's bicycle in the garage, Andy?"
"Yeah, thanks, Mrs. Wall."
She always, he reflected, said, "your father," never "your dad." Andrew knew that Tessa detested Simon. It was one of the things that made him please to overlook the horrible shapeless clothes she wore and the unflattering blunt-cut fringe. Her antipathy dated from that horrific, epoch-making occasion years and years before when a 6-year-old Fats had come to spend Saturday afternoon at Hilltop House for the first time. Balancing precariously on top of a box in the garage, trying to retrieve a couple of old badminton rackets, the two boys had accidentally knocked down the contents of a rickety shelf. Andrew remembered the tin of creosote falling, smashing onto the roof of the car and bursting open, and the terror that had engulfed him and his inability to communicate to his giggling friend what they had brought upon themselves. Simon had heard the crash. He ran out to the garage and advanced on them with his jaw jutting, making his low, moaning animal noise, before starting to roar threats of dire physical punishment, his fists clenched inches from their small upturned faces. Fats had wet himself. A stream of urine had splattered down the inside of his shorts onto the garage floor. Ruth, who had heard the yelling from the kitchen, had run from the house to intervene.
"No, Si, no, it was an accident."
Fats was white and shaking. He wanted to go home straight away. He wanted his mum. Tessa had arrived, and Fats had run to her in his soaking shorts, sobbing. It was the only time in his life that Andrew had seen his father at a loss, backing down. Somehow, Tessa had conveyed white-hot fury without raising her voice, without threatening, without hitting. She had written out a cheque and forced it into Simon's hand, while Ruth said, "No, no, there's no need, there's no need." Simon had followed her to her car, trying to laugh it all off, but Tessa had given him a look of contempt while loading the still sobbing Fats into the passenger seat and slammed the driver's door in Simon's smiling face. Andrew had seen his parents' expressions. Tessa was taking away with her, down the hill into the town, something that usually remained hidden in the house on top of the hill. Fats courted Simon these days. Whenever he came up to Hilltop House, he went out of his way to make Simon laugh, and in return, Simon welcomed Fats's visits, enjoyed his crudest jokes, liked hearing about his antics. Still, when alone with Andrew, Fats concurred wholeheartedly that Simon was a grade A, 24-carat cunt. "I reckon she's a leser," said Fats, as they walked past the old vicarage, dark in the shadow of the Scots pine, with ivy covering its front. "Your mum?" asked Andrew, barely listening, lost in his own thoughts. "What?" yelped Fats, and Andrew saw that he was genuinely outraged. "Fuck off! Sukhvinder Jawanda!" "Oh, yeah, right," Andrew laughed, and so, a beat later, did Fats. The bus into Yarville was crowded. Andrew and Fats had to sit next to each other rather than in two double seats, as they preferred. As they passed the end of Hope Street, Andrew glanced along it, but it was deserted. He had not run into Gaia outside school since the afternoon when they had both secured Saturday jobs at the Copper Kettle. The cafe would open the following weekend. He experienced waves of euphoria every time he thought of it. "Saipai's election campaign on track, is it?" asked Fats, busy making roll-ups. One long leg was stuck out at an angle into the aisle of the bus. People were stepping over it rather than asking him to move. "Cubby's cacking it already, and he's only making his pamphlet." "Yeah, he's busy," said Andrew. And he bore without flinching a silent eruption of panic in the pit of his stomach. He thought of his parents at the kitchen table, as they had been nightly for the past week, of a box of stupid pamphlets that Simon had printed at work, of the list of talking points Ruth had helped Simon compile, which he used as he made telephone calls every evening to every person he knew within the electoral boundary. Simon did all of it with an air of immense effort. He was tightly wound at home, displaying heightened aggression towards his sons. He might have been shouldering a burden that they had shirked. The only topic of conversation at meals was the election, with Simon and Ruth speculating about the forces ranged against Simon. They took it very personally that other candidates were standing for Barry Fairbrother's old seat, and seemed to assume that Colin Wall and Miles Mollison spent most of their time plotting together, staring up at Hilltop House, focused entirely on defeating the man who had lived there. Andrew checked his pocket again for the folded paper. He had not told Fats what he intended to do. He was afraid that Fats might broadcast it. Andrew was not sure how to impress upon his friend the necessity for absolute secrecy, how to remind Fats that the maniac who had made little boys piss themselves was alive and well and living in Andrew's house. "Cubby's not too worried about Saipai," said Fats. "He thinks the big competition is Miles Mollison." "Yeah," said Andrew. He had heard his parents discussing it. Both of them seemed to think that Shirley had betrayed them, that she ought to have forbidden her son from challenging Simon. "This is a holy fucking crusade for Cubby, you know," said Fats, rolling a cigarette between forefinger and thumb. "He's picking up the regimental flag for his fallen comrade, old Barry Fairbrother." He poked strands of tobacco into the end of the roll-up with a match. "Miles Mollison's wife's got gigantic tits," said Fats. An elderly woman sitting in front of them turned her head to glare at Fats. Andrew began to laugh again. "Humongous, bouncing jubblies," Fats said loudly into the scowling, crumpled face. "Great, big, juicy, double F mams." She turned her red face slowly to face the front of the bus again. Andrew could barely breathe. They got off the bus in the middle of Yarville, near the precinct and main pedestrian-only shopping street,
and wove their way through the shoppers, smoking Fats's roll-ups. Andrew had virtually no money left. Howard Mollison's wages would be very welcome. The bright orange sign of the internet cafe seemed to blaze at Andrew from a distance, beckoning him on. He could not concentrate on what Fats was saying. "Are you going to?" he kept asking himself. "Are you going to?" He did not know. His feet kept moving, and the sign was growing larger and larger, luring him, leering at him.
"If I find out you've breathed a word about what's said in this house, I'll skin you alive."
But the alternative, the humiliation of having Simon show what he was to the world, the toll it would take on the family when, after weeks of anticipation and idiocy, he was defeated, as he must be, then would come rage and spite, and a determination to make everybody else pay for his own lunatic decisions. Only the previous evening, Ruth had said brightly, "The boys will go through Pagford and post your pamphlets for you." Andrew had seen, in his peripheral vision, Paul's look of horror and his attempts to make eye contact with his brother.
"I want to go in there," mumbled Andrew, turning right.
They bought tickets with codes on them and sat down at different computers, two occupied seats apart. The middle-aged man on Andrew's right stank of body odor and old fags and kept sniffing. Andrew logged onto the internet and typed in the name of the website, pagfordparishcouncil.co.uk. The homepage bore the council's arms in blue and white and a picture of Pagford that had been taken from a point close to Hilltop House with Pargeter Abbey silhouetted against the sky. The site, as Andrew already knew, from looking at it on a school computer, looked dated and amateurish. He had not dared go near it on his own laptop. His father might be immensely ignorant about the internet, but Andrew did not rule out the possibility that Simon might find somebody at work who could help him investigate once the thing was done. Even in this bustling, anonymous place, there was no avoiding the fact that today's date would be on the posting, or of pretending that he had not been in Yarville when it happened. But Simon had never visited an internet cafe in his life, and might not be aware that they existed. The rapid contraction of Andrew's heart was painful. Swiftly, he scrolled down the message board, which did not seem to enjoy a lot of traffic. There were threads entitled "Refuse Collection, a Query," and "School Catchment Areas in Crampton and Little Manning." Every tenth entry or so was a posting from the administrator attaching minutes of the last council meeting. Right at the bottom of the page was a thread entitled "Death of Councillor Barry Fairbrother." This had received 152 views and 43 responses. Then, on the second page of the message board, he found what he hoped to find: a post from the dead man. A couple of months previously, Andrew's computing set had been supervised by a young supply teacher. He had been trying to look cool, trying to get the class on side. He shouldn't have mentioned SQL injections at all, and Andrew was quite sure that he had not been the only one who went straight home and looked them up. He pulled out the piece of paper on which he had written the code he had researched in odd moments at school, and brought up the login page on the council website. Everything hinged on the premise that the site had been set up by an amateur a long time ago, that it had never been protected from the simplest of classical hacks. Carefully, using only his index finger, he input the magic line of characters. He read them through twice, making sure that every apostrophe was where it should be, hesitated for a second on the brink, his breathing shallow, then pressed return. He gasped, as gleeful as a small child, and had to fight the urge to shout out or punch the air. He had penetrated the tin pot site at his first attempt. There, on the screen in front of him, were Barry Fairbrother's user details, his name, his password, his entire profile. Andrew smoothed out the magic paper he'd kept under his pillow all week and set to work. Typing up his next paragraph, with its many crossings out and reworkings, was a much more laborious process. He had been trying for a style that was as impersonal and impenetrable as possible for the dispassionate tone of a broadsheet journalist. Aspiring parish councillor Simon Price hopes to stand on a platform of cutting wasteful council spending. Mr. Price is certainly no stranger to keeping down costs and should be able to give the council the benefit of his many useful contacts. He saves money at home by furnishing it with stolen goods, most recently a PC, and he is the go-to man for any cut-price printing jobs that may need doing for cash once senior management has gone home, at the Harcourt Walsh Print Works. Andrew read the message through twice. He had been over it time and again in his mind. There were many accusations he could have levelled at Simon, but the court did not exist in which Andrew could have laid the real charges against his father, in which he would have presented as evidence memories of physical terror and ritual humiliation. All he had were the many petty infractions of the law of which he had heard Simon boast, and he had selected these two specific examples, the stolen computer and the out-of-hours printing jobs done on the sly, because both were firmly connected to Simon's workplace. People at the printers knew that Simon did these things, and they could have talked to anybody, their friends, their families. His guts were juddering, the way that they did when Simon truly lost control and laid about anyone within reach. Seeing his betrayal in black and white on the screen was terrifying.
"What the fuck are you doing?" asked Fats's quiet voice in his ear.
The stinking middle-aged man had gone. Fats had moved up. He was reading what Andrew had written.
"Fucking hell," said Fats.
Andrew's mouth was dry. His hand lay quiescent on the mouse.
"How'd you get in?" Fats whispered. "SQL injection," said Andrew. "It's all on the net. Their security's shit."
Fats looked exhilarated, wildly impressed. Andrew was half pleased, half scared by the reaction.
"You've got to keep this to..." "Let me do one about Cubby."
"No." Andrew's hand on the mouse skidded away from Fats's reaching fingers. This ugly act of filial disloyalty had sprung from the primordial soup of anger, frustration and fear that had slopped inside him all his rational life. But he knew no better way to convey this to Fats than by saying, "I'm not just having a laugh." He read the message through a third time, then added a title to the message. He could feel Fats's excitement beside him, as if they were having another porn session. Andrew was seized by a desire to impress further.
"Look," he said,
and he changed Barry's username to "The Ghost of Barry Fairbrother." Fats laughed loudly. Andrew's fingers twitched on the mouse. He rolled it sideways. Whether he would have gone through with it if Fats had not been watching, he would never know. With a single click, a new thread appeared at the top of the Pagford Parish Council message board. Simon Price, unfit to stand for council. Outside on the pavement, they faced each other, breathless with laughter, slightly overawed by what had happened. Then Andrew borrowed Fats's matches, set fire the piece of paper on which he had drafted the message, and watched it disintegrate into fragile black flakes, which drifted onto the dirty pavement and vanished under passing feet.
10. Andrew left Yarville at 3:30 to be sure of getting back to Hilltop House before 5. Fats accompanied him to the bus stop and then, apparently on a whim, told Andrew that he thought he would stay in town for a bit after all. Fats had made a loose arrangement to meet Crystal in the shopping centre. He strolled back towards the shops, thinking about what Andrew had done in the internet cafe and trying to disentangle his own reactions. He had to admit that he was impressed. In fact, he felt somewhat upstaged. Andrew had thought the business through and kept it to himself and executed it efficiently. All of this was admirable. Fats experienced a twinge of pique that Andrew had formulated the plan without saying a word to him, and this led Fats to wonder whether perhaps he ought not to deplore the undercover nature of Andrew's attack on his father. Was there not something slippery and over-sophisticated about it? Would it not have been more authentic to threaten Simon to his face or to take a swing at him?
Yes, Simon was a shit, but he was undoubtedly an authentic shit. He did what he wanted, when he wanted, without submitting to societal constraints or conventional morality. Fats asked himself whether his sympathies ought not to lie with Simon, whom he liked entertaining with crude, crass humour, focused mainly on people making tits of themselves or suffering slapstick injuries. Fats often told himself that he would rather have Simon, with his volatility, his unpredictable picking of fights, a worthy opponent, an engaged adversary, than Cubby. On the other hand, Fats had not forgotten the falling tin of creosote, Simon's brutish face and fists, the terrifying noise he had made, the sensation of hot, wet piss running down his own legs, and, perhaps most shameful of all, his wholehearted, desperate yearning for Tessa to come and take him away to safety. Fats was not yet so invulnerable that he was unsympathetic to Andrew's desire for retribution. So Fats came full circle. Andrew had done something daring, ingenious, and potentially explosive in its consequences. Again, Fats experienced a small pang of chagrin that it had not been he who had thought of it. He was trying to rid himself of his own acquired middle-class reliance on words, but it was difficult to forego a sport at which he excelled, and as he trod the polished tiles of the shopping centre forecourt, he found himself turning phrases that would blow Cubby's self-important pretensions apart and strip him naked before a jeering public. He spotted Crystal among a small crowd of Fields kids grouped around the benches in the middle of the thoroughfare between shops. Nicky, Leanne, and Dane Tully were among them. Fats did not hesitate, nor appear to gather himself in the slightest, but continued to walk at the same speed, his hands in his pockets, into the battery of curious, critical eyes, raking him from the top of his head to his trainers.
"All right, fat boy," called Leanne.
"All right," responded Fats.
Leanne muttered something to Nicky, who cackled. Crystal was chewing gum energetically, colour high in her cheeks, throwing back her hair so that her earrings danced, tugging up her tracksuit bottoms.
"All right," Fats said to her, individually.
"Yeah," she said.
"Does your mum know you're out, Fats?" asked Nicky.
"Yeah, she brought me," said Fats calmly, into the greedy silence. "She's waiting outside in the car. She says I can have a quick shag before we go home for tea."
They all burst out laughing except Crystal, who squealed,
"Fuck off, you cheeky bastard,"
but looked gratified.
"You smoking rollies?"
grunted Dane Tully, his eyes on Fats's breast pocket. He had a large black scab on his lip.
"Yeah," said Fats.
"Me uncle smokes them," said Dane. "Knackered his fucking lungs."
He picked idly at the scab.
"Where are you two going?"
asked Leanne, squinting from Fats to Crystal.
"Dunno,"
said Crystal, chewing her gum, glancing sideways at Fats. He did not enlighten either of them, but indicated the exit of the shopping centre with a jerk of his thumb.
"Laters,"
Crystal said loudly to the rest. Fats gave them a careless, half-raised hand in farewell and walked away, Crystal striding along beside him. He heard more laughter in their wake, but did not care. He knew that he had acquitted himself well.
"Where are we going?" asked Crystal.
"Dunno," said Fats.
"Where do you usually go?"
She shrugged, walking and chewing. They left the shopping centre and walked on down the high street. They were some distance from the recreation ground, where they had previously gone to find privacy.
"Did your mum really drop you?"
Crystal asked.
"Course she bloody didn't. I got the bus in, didn't I?"
Crystal accepted the rebuke without rancour, glancing sideways into the shop windows at their paired reflections. Stringy and strange, Fats was a school celebrity. Even Dane thought he was funny.
"He's only using you, you stupid bitch,"
Ashley Mellor had spat at her 3 days ago on the corner of Foley Road,
"because you're a fucking whore like your mum."
Ashley had been a member of Crystal's gang until the two of them had clashed over another boy. Ashley was notoriously not quite right in the head. She was prone to outbursts of rage and tears and divided most of her time between learning support and guidance when at Winterdown. If further proof were needed of her inability to think through consequences, she had challenged Crystal on her home turf,
where Crystal had backup and she had none. Nikki, Gemma and Leanne had helped corner and hold Ashley, and Crystal had pummeled and slapped her everywhere she could reach until her knuckles came away bloody from the other girl's mouth. Crystal was not worried about repercussions.
"Soft as shite and twice as runny," she said of Ashley and her family, but Ashley's words had stung a tender, infected place in Crystal's psyche. So it had been a balm to her when Fats had sought her out at school the next day and asked her, for the first time, to meet him over the weekend. She had told Nikki and Leanne immediately that she was going out with Fats Wall on Saturday, and had been gratified by their looks of surprise, and to cap it all, he had turned up when he said he would, or within half an hour of it, right in front of all her mates, and walked away with her. It was like they were properly going out.
"So what have you been up to?" Fats asked, after they'd walked 50 yards in silence back past the internet cafe. He knew a conventional need to keep some form of communication going, even while he wondered whether they would find a private place before the wreck, a half hour's walk away. He wanted to screw her while they were both stoned. He was curious to know what that was like.
"I've been to see my nana in hospital this morning. She's had a stroke," said Crystal.
Nana Kath had not tried to speak this time, but Crystal thought she had known that she was there. As Crystal had expected, Terry was refusing to visit, so Crystal had sat beside the bed on her own for an hour until it was time to leave for the precinct. Fats was curious about the minutiae of Crystal's life, but only insofar as she was an entry point to the real life of the fields. Particulars such as hospital visits were of no interest to him. "Anne," Crystal added, with an irrepressible spurt of pride,
"I gave an interview to the paper."
"What?" said Fats, startled. "Why?"
"Just about the fields," said Crystal.
"What it's like growing up there." The journalist had found her at home at last, and when Terry had given her grudging permission, taken her to a cafe to talk. She had kept asking her whether being at St. Thomas's had helped Crystal, whether it had changed her life in any way. She had seemed a little impatient and frustrated by Crystal's answers.
"How are your marks at school?"
she had said, and Crystal had been evasive and defensive.
"Mr. Fairbrother said that he thought it broadened your horizons."
Crystal did not know what to say about horizons. When she thought of St. Thomas's, it was of her delight in the playing field with the big chestnut tree, which rained enormous glossy conkers on them every year. She had never seen conkers before she went to St. Thomas's. She had liked the uniform at first, liked looking the same as everybody else. She had been excited to see her great-grandfather's name on the war memorial in the middle of the square. Private Samuel Whedon. Only one other boy had his surname on the war memorial, and that was a farmer's son who had been able to drive a tractor at 9 and who had once brought a lamb into class for show and tell. Crystal had never forgotten the sensation of the lamb's fleece under her hand. When she told Nana Kath about it, Nana Kath had said that their family had been farm labourers once. Crystal had loved the river, green and lush, where they had gone for nature walks. Best of all had been rounders and athletics. She was always first to be picked for any kind of sporting team, and she had delighted in the groan that went up from the other team whenever she was chosen. And she thought sometimes of the special teachers she'd been given, especially Miss Jameson, who had been young and trendy, with long blonde hair. Crystal had always imagined Anne-Marie to be a bit like Miss Jameson. Then there were snippets of information that Crystal had retained in vivid, accurate detail. Volcanoes. They were made by plates shifting in the ground. They had made model ones, and filled them with bicarbonate of soda and washing up liquid, and they had erupted onto plastic trays. Crystal had loved that. She knew about Vikings, too. They had long ships and horned helmets, though she'd forgotten when they arrived in Britain, or why. But other memories of St. Thomas's included the muttered comments made about her by little girls in her class, one or two of whom she had slapped. When social services had allowed her to go back to her mother, her uniform became so tight, short and grubby that letters were sent from school, and Nana Kath and Terry had a big row. The other girls at school had not wanted her in their groups, except for their rounders teams. She could still remember Lexi Mollison
handing everyone in the class a little pink envelope containing a party invitation and walking past Crystal with, as Crystal remembered it, her nose in the air. Only a couple of people had asked her to parties. She wondered whether Fats or his mother remembered that she'd once attended a birthday party at their house. The whole class had been invited, and Nana Kath had bought Crystal a party dress. So she knew that Fats's huge back garden had a pond and a swing and an apple tree. They had eaten jelly and had sack races. Tessa had told Crystal off because, trying desperately hard to win a plastic medal, she'd pushed other children out of the way. One of them had had a nosebleed. "You enjoyed St. Thomas's, though, did you?" the journalist had asked. "Yeah," said Crystal. But she knew that she'd not conveyed what Mr. Fairbrother had wanted her to convey, and wished he could have been there with her to help. "Yeah, I enjoyed it." "How come they want to talk to you about the fields?" asked Fats. "It were Mr. Fairbrother's idea," said Crystal. After another few minutes, Fats asked, "Do you smoke?" "What, like spliffs?" "Yeah, I done it with Dane." "I've got some on me," said Fats. "Get it off Sky Kirby, did you?" asked Crystal. He wondered whether he imagined a trace of amusement in her voice, because Sky was the soft, safe option, the place the middle-class kids went. If so, Fats liked her authentic derision. "Where'd you get yours, then?" he asked, interested now. "I dunno, it were Dane's," she said. "From Obbo," suggested Fats. "That fucking tosser. What's wrong with him?" But Crystal had no words for what was wrong with Obbo, and even if she had, she would not have wanted to talk about him. Obbo made her flesh crawl. Sometimes he came round and shot up with Terry. At other times he fucked her, and Crystal would meet him on the stairs, tugging up his filthy fly, smiling at her through his bottle-bottomed glasses. Often, Obbo had little jobs to offer Terry, like hiding the computers or giving strangers a place to stay for a night or agreeing to perform services of which Crystal did not know the nature, but which took her mother out of the house for hours. Crystal had had a nightmare not long ago in which her mother had become stretched, spread, and tied on a kind of frame. She was mostly a vast, gaping hole like a giant, raw, plucked chicken, and in the dream, Obbo was walking in and out of this cavernous interior and fiddling with things in there while Terry's tiny head was frightened and grim. Crystal had woken up feeling sick and angry and disgusted. "He's a fucker," said Crystal. "Is he a tall bloke with a shaved head and tattoos all up the back of his neck?" asked Fats, who had truanted for a second time that week and sat on a wall for an hour in the fields, watching. The bald man had interested him, fiddling around in the back of an old white van. "Now, that's Pikey Pritchard," said Crystal, "if you saw him down Tarpon Road." "What does he do?" "I dunno," said Crystal. "Ask Dane, he's mates with Pikey's brother." But she liked his genuine interest. He'd never shown this much inclination to talk to her before. "Pikey's on probation." "What for?" "He'd last a bloke down across Keys." "Why?" "How the fuck do I know? I went there," said Crystal. She was happy, which always made her cocky. Setting aside her worry about Nana Kath, who was, after all, still alive, so might yet recover, it had been a good couple of weeks. Terry was adhering to the Bell Chapel regime again, and Crystal was making sure that Robbie went to nursery. His bottom had mostly healed over. The social worker seemed as pleased as her sort ever did. Crystal had been to school every day, too, though she had not attended either her Monday or her Wednesday morning guidance sessions with Tessa. She did not know why. Sometimes you got out of the habit. She glanced sideways at Fats again. She had never once thought of fancying him, not until he'd targeted her at the disco in the drama hall. Everyone knew Fats. Some of his jokes were passed around like funny stuff that happened on the telly. Crystal pretended to everyone that they had a television at home. She watched enough at friends' houses and at Nana Kath's to be able to bluff her way through. "Yeah, it was shit, weren't it? I know I nearly pissed myself," she would say, when the others talked about programs they had seen. Fats was imagining how it would feel to be glassed, how the jagged shard would slice through the tender flesh on his face, He could feel the searing nerves and the sting of the air against his ripped skin, the warm wetness as blood gushed. He felt a tickly oversensitivity in the skin around his mouth, as if it were already scarred. "Is he still carrying a blade, Dane?" he asked. "How do you know he's got a blade?" demanded Crystal. "He threatened Kevin Cooper with it." "Oh, yeah," Crystal conceded. "Cooper's a twat, isn't he?" "Yeah, he is," said Fats. "Dane's only carrying because of the Reardon brothers," said Crystal. Fats liked the matter-of-factness of Crystal's tone, her acceptance of the need for a knife because there was a grudge and a likelihood of violence. This was the raw reality of life. These were things that actually mattered. Before Arf had arrived at the house that day, Cubby had been importuning Tessa to give him an opinion on whether his campaign leaflet should be printed on yellow or white paper. "What about in there?" suggested Fats, after a while. To their right was a long stone wall, its gates open to reveal a glimpse of green and stone. "Yeah, all right," said Crystal. She had been in the cemetery once before with Nicky and Leanne. They had sat on a grave and split a couple of cans, a little self-conscious about what they were doing, until a woman had shouted at them and called them names. Leanne had lobbed an empty can back at the woman as they left. But it was too exposed, Fats thought, as he and Crystal walked up the broad, concreted walkway between the graves, green and flat, the headstones offering virtually no cover. Then he saw barberry hedges along the wall on the far side. He cut a path right across the cemetery, and Crystal followed, hands in her pockets, as they picked their way between rectangular gravel beds, headstones cracked and illegible. It was a large cemetery, wide and well-tended. Gradually, they reached the newer graves of highly polished black marble with gold lettering, places where fresh flowers had been laid for the recently dead. "To Lindsay Kyle, September the 15th, 1960, to March the 26th, 2008. Sleep tight, Mum." "Yeah, we'll be all right in there," said Fats, eyeing the dark gap between the prickly yellow-flowered bushes and the cemetery wall. They crawled into the damp shadows, onto the earth, their backs against the cold wall. The headstones marched away from them between the bushes' trunks, but there were no human forms among them. Fats skinned up expertly, hoping that Crystal was watching and was impressed. But she was gazing out under the canopy of glossy dark leaves, thinking about Anne-Marie, who, Aunt Cheryl had told her, had come to visit Nana Kath on Thursday. If only she'd skipped school and gone at the same time, they could have met at last. She had fantasized many times about how she would meet Anne-Marie and say to her, "I'm your sister." Anne-Marie, in these fantasies, was always delighted. And they saw each other all the time after that, and eventually Anne-Marie suggested that Crystal move in. The imaginary Anne-Marie had a house like Nana Kath's, neat and clean, except that it was much more modern. Lately, in her fantasies, Crystal had added a sweet little pink baby in a frilly crib. "There you go," said Fats, handing Crystal the joint. She inhaled, held the smoke in her lungs for a few seconds, and her expression softened into dreaminess as the cannabis worked its magic. "You ain't got brothers and sisters," she asked, "have you?" "No," said Fats, checking his pocket for the condoms he had brought. Crystal handed back the joint, her head swimming pleasantly. Fats took an enormous drag and blew smoke rings. "I'm adopted," he said, after a while. Crystal goggled at Fats.
"Are you adopted, are you?"
With the senses a little muffled and cushioned, confidences peeled easily away, everything became easy.
"My sister was adopted," said Crystal,
marvelling at the coincidence, delighted to talk about Anne-Marie.
"Yeah, I probably came from a family like yours," said Fats. But Crystal was not listening. She wanted to talk.
"I got an older sister and an older brother, Liam, but they was taken away before I was born."
"Why?" asked Fats.
He was suddenly paying close attention.
"Me mum was with Richie Adams then," said Crystal.
She took a deep drag on the joint and blew out the smoke in a long, thin jet.
"He's a proper psycho. He's doing life. He killed a bloke. proper violent to Mum and the kids, and then John and Sue came and took them, and the social got involved, and it ended up John and Sue kept them. She drew on the joint again, considering this period of her pre-life, which was doused in blood, fury, and darkness.